Is it possible to identify the biblical Queen of Sheba? That's the topic of today's discussion and interview with Christopher Eames. The feature article in our latest edition of Let the Stone Speak attempts to answer this question, and it looks like we have a pretty good candidate. If you're not subscribed to our magazine, please go ahead to our website, armstronginstitute.org. You'll find a place on the front page to sign up for the mag. Also, if you like our content here online, don't forget to like and subscribe this video on YouTube. Hi, Chris. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hello, Brent. It's great to be back.
Yeah, we're really excited to talk about this with you. This is kind of the latest in the series of identifying biblical figures with personalities from the historic world, be it archaeology or literature. And now you're tackling one of the big ones, the famous Queen of Sheba that visited King Solomon in Jerusalem 3,000 years ago. And you think that you have a pretty good candidate as to a historic personality that fits the bill. So where should we start in the discussion about this individual?
Well, I think we should start with the vagueness about her in some of the written sources and how this contributes to some of the questions about who she could be. A lot of the answers for who she is gets down to a discussion of territory, but perhaps a good beginning point would be talking about some of this vagueness in some of the written sources. Now, this subject has been close to my heart for a while. It just got published in our latest magazine, but I went back to the Word document, and it was about 3 years ago that I started the Word document itself. So I've been chipping away at this for a while, a subject that I've been really interested in. But the account of the visit of the famous visit of the Queen of Sheba, we read about it in the Hebrew Bible, famously 1 Kings chapter 10. There is a second parallel account in the Hebrew Bible, which is 2 Chronicles 9. Many of the same details repeated there. So from these accounts, we read several details of her visit, but we don't get her name. She's just referred to generally as this Queen of Sheba. Now, she also makes an appearance in the New Testament account. So there's a couple of places which refer to her as the Queen of the South. So we have a little detail there. She's somewhere south. But again, we don't get a name. And then again, in the Quran, this text refers to her visit as well. But again, she is not named. And it's not until centuries later that we have some Arabic commentators who are giving her this name of Bilqis, which seems to be an artificial name anyway, and we can go into that. So from all these angles, we have this haziness when it comes to the Queen of Sheba. She comes from some distant foreign location, somewhere to the south, bringing this great train of goods. The biblical account describes it, the precious stones and gold and spices that it talks about several times. But who exactly is she? There have been some attempts to try and identify her with a historical figure based on some of the textual clues. Now, most in modern scholarship seem to identify her with the Arabian Peninsula, especially the southwestern Arabian Peninsula. So really, pinpointing the territory is key with answering this question. So in my article in the latest Let the Stone Speak and available on the website, I start out by emphasizing, like as a case in point, Professor Kenneth Kitchen, who just died last year, the late Kenneth Kitchen, Egyptologist. He basically paints it as conclusive that this queen came from the southwestern Arabian Peninsula, from this territory described as Saba or Sheba, an alternate word that could be rendered as Sheba. And he highlights these trade caravans that we know of from Assyrian records from the late 8th century BCE onwards. And so he says, okay, we have got these records of these trade caravans. So as they freely traded goods north, so could the Queen of Sheba have done. There's a slight problem there, is that these records are 2 centuries plus after the right. time period of the Queen of Sheba. But nevertheless, that's where Kitchen identifies her territorially as part of this Sabaean kingdom. And he actually calls it a universal identification. And then I show another example from an Arabian expert or an expert in early Islamic studies and ancient Arabia called Professor Patricia Crone. She also died not that long ago. She published a book just the year after Kitchen's book, saying there's no way the Queen of Sheba is a southwestern Arabian queen. Right. She must have been a northwestern right. Arabian queen. And she's right. like, well, we have no attestation of queens at all from southwest Arabia, let alone monarchy itself from the time of the 10th century. So we don't have any attestation for monarchy at the right time, let alone these queens. And that we do have some attestation of queens from northern Arabia. And so she identifies this northern Arabian Peninsula area as the origin point for the Queen of Sheba. So generally, a lot of the scholarship has gravitated around this Arabian Peninsula identification. Let's just say western side of the Arabian Peninsula, whether or not you go north or south. Now, there is...
Which is strange, because if you just talk to any kind of more, like a layperson that isn't so into it, there, if you say the Queen of Sheba and putting them with a people, they would probably not put them in Arabia.
Yeah, yeah, there's another location entirely, like another continent where which has been identified with this Sheba location in various traditions, and that is northeastern Africa. So interestingly enough, that there is very strong connection among the Ethiopians with the Queen of Sheba, and this goes right back to Josephus. So the first century, this clearly goes right back to right. Josephus, and he writes about in Antiquities of the Jews. He writes about this Queen of Sheba, and he is dogmatic that she comes from, that she was the queen of Egypt and Ethiopia, is how he introduces her. And then later on, he mentions her as a queen of Ethiopia alone.
Right.
So the emphasis in Josephus's writings is that she is attached to Ethiopia primarily, and secondarily somehow to Egypt. But in any case, not on the Arabian Peninsula. He very much identifies her with northeastern Africa, shall we say more generally. And it's important to point out when we refer to Ethiopia, or Josephus refers to Ethiopia, that is a more broader sense, shall we say, of the word, rather than the fixed modern state of Ethiopia. Right. So in the original Greek usage, the term Ethiopia was for the region south of the border of Egypt. And right. it refers to the appearance of the darker complexion of the peoples. Literally, it means something like burnt face. So it, right. it's referring to the darker complexion of the peoples south of Egypt. So a bit more broader, including Sudan.
Yeah, so there's no Sudan anciently. We're just, if you took biblical, you know, geography, it'd just be like Egypt, then Ethiopia.
Yep, that's right.
There's the contiguous.
Yep. So these two, we basically have these two primary regions which have been proposed, and they're not as far removed as
right.
you might imagine. I mean, they're just divided by the Red Sea at this point, the main body of the Red Sea. But historically, these general regions, however we want to define them, have been in various points in history combined as part of the same kingdom. So most famously, this is part of the Abyssinian kingdom, which really flourished in the first millennium CE. Ruled from Aksum in northern modern Ethiopia. And then going back earlier, we run into some difficulties in how we define and how we delineate these territories. So famously,
it's not far as well. Like, people should realize that it's, you know, the straight, I don't know, I think it's 22 miles, something like that, Bab el-Mandeb.
Yeah.
I was actually reading an article before this interview about how Iran is using the Houthis to mobilize what's happening in Sudan. So it's like, you know, there's still this, you know, these areas can really belong together, even though you've got the Red Sea dividing them. It's not that far across.
Right. Very much so. And there's even potential link in the biblical accounts relating to the Queen of Sheba, both in 1 Kings 10 and 2 Chronicles 9, of possible sea trade from the Queen of Sheba herself, or somehow contributing to that. So easily could have been vessels going back and forth and through the strait. So it's easy to see how that may have happened. Now, a lot of the connection with Saba, or the Sabaean kingdom, Shebaite kingdom, if you like, has once again been related to these Sabaean inscriptions from Southwest Arabia and the western side of Arabia. But we do find Sabaean inscriptions in Northeast Africa as well. Now, mm-hmm. during these earlier kingdoms, it's hard to understand. We have less remains, and it's hard to understand how they relate to one another. There is some mysterious entity on the scene in the early first millennium BCE onwards in Northeastern Africa, which has been named the DMT kingdom, not the drug, like D apostrophe MT, Dharmat is one way you could pronounce it, in which we have a lot of these Sabaean inscriptions on the African side.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our viewers might be familiar with the Ophel Pithos inscription, which we've highlighted in the past as this connection to Sheba and the kingdom of Saba. And this is a Sabaean inscription that was found here in Jerusalem's Ophel with the Sabaean script on it, otherwise known as Ancient South Arabian. Now, funnily enough, despite the name Ancient South Arabian, this is not the script that Arabic descended from. It is the script that the modern Ge'ez Ethiopian script descended from, but it's not the script that the Arabic script descended from. So you do have its preservation and promulgation within Northeastern Africa, but not within Arabia, which has its own genealogy for its script through Nabataean. So we've got these two sides of a coin. We've got the African side and the Arabian side. We've got similar scripts on both sides. So it's a matter of determining which is the right one. If Josephus mm-hmm. really was right, or if he was conflating some things, maybe he was wrong. He's writing at a later time than the Queen of Sheba. Maybe it was just on the Arabian side. So this two-sided question, what I try and do in the article is do a bit more digging in the biblical account and see if we get any clues as to that. Now, there does seem to be a reflection of this two-sided coin situation in the biblical account. And for this, we go right back to the Table of Nations in Genesis 10. And there is one particular entity whose name is mentioned twice in all these genealogies of people, places, and locations. And can you guess what it is? It's Sheba. And Sheba is referred to as a descendant of Ham mm-hmm. Through Cush. So clearly African, Cushites. Cush meaning black, Ham meaning heat. And then Sheba is also mentioned in the genealogy of Shem through Joktan, which he is generally associated with southern Arabia. So these place names, It's easy to think of them as perhaps personal names, and many of them are, but they yep. can also be referring to place names in which the descendants lived. Doesn't necessarily mean a descendant of Shem and a descendant of Ham through Cush had these exact same Hebrew spellings for their names. It refers to their descendants living within this kingdom. And it's interesting, if you go through the mentions in the Bible of Sheba in relation to the visit of the Queen of Sheba, and associate with which one it fits best with. Now, there is a psalm, Psalm 72. Its header is a Psalm of Solomon, and it talks about Sheba bringing gifts. So obviously, this is an allusion to this visit of the Queen of Sheba. And it talks about two entities bringing gifts together, Sheba and Seba. And Seba is a brother of Sheba, if you like, within the Cushite lineage in Genesis 10. And it is also mentioned in reference to Egypt and Cush in Isaiah. So here we have Sheba right next to brother Seba in the delivery of these objects to Solomon. So that gives us an inference that we're talking about African, more African-aligned trade. Now you go to a later book like Ezekiel 27, chapter 27, that talks about trade coming from Sheba in distinction to Arabian merchants. And it mentions Sheba bringing exactly the same items as at the time of Solomon. 1 Kings 10 talks about the precious stones, the gold, the spices. And it says Sheba does this with Rama. And Rama is another of the brothers in that Cushite lineage there. So these names,
Rather than the Semitic lineage.
Yeah, are all mentioned in this African context here. Mm-hmm. So putting that together with Josephus, who is very dogmatic, Queen of Sheba, comes from this area of Ethiopia, Sudan/Ethiopia. And you have the evidence trending in a certain direction as coming from this area.
So people can definitely, we'll leave a link for it, dig into this. If anything is going over your head, definitely go to the article and have a look for further detail on each of these points. All right, so you've narrowed it. We're gonna go with Northeast Africa to try and locate the queen. What do we have there as far as tradition goes for the Queen of Sheba located somewhere in this area?
Okay, so the tradition is quite important. We started out by reviewing some of these mentions in these major sources, Hebrew Bible, New Testament, Quran, all of which mention her, none of which name her. Mm-hmm. Within Ethiopian tradition, our first major mention of her names her right from the get-go as the great Makeda. And this is found in this great epic of Ethiopia known as the Kebra Nagast, the Glory of the Kings. This was formalized, as we know it, in the 14th century CE. So comparatively late, but still relaying an earlier tradition, linking the kings of Ethiopia right back to the Queen of Sheba, and actually right back a lot further to basically the Genesis 10 Table of Nations. Like, it's really detailed in how it gives the genealogies all the way back. And it contains a lot of emphasis on the Queen of Sheba, Makeda, and her interactions and her travel with Solomon. Now, we get more of a bare bones account in the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. But in later texts, these texts within Jewish tradition and Islamic tradition from the first millennium CE, we get a lot of fantastical elements which are worked in, like in the Targum Shani, the Jewish tradition, some of the Islamic traditions. They talk about Solomon's palace and all the animals that he's able to communicate with, and jinn and demons, and how he brings the Queen of Sheba to him with a hoopoe bird who goes along and brings the Queen of Sheba to him. And it talks about this this trickery which is put upon the Queen of Sheba at Solomon's palace to reveal whether or not she's a demon to have her lift her skirt.
A few more mythical elements to this story.
Yeah, so a lot of fantastical elements here. Arabic tradition has it that she's half jinn, shape-shifting jinn. So you get a lot of weird fantastical elements. Now, you compare that to the Kebra Nagas, the Ethiopian tradition. Now, there is a great Ethiopian history expert, again, deceased not that long ago, Professor Edward Ullendorf. He writes about the Kebra Nagas, basically compares it to the Quran for Islam, New Testament for Christians, Hebrew Bible for Jews, and sees it as the great religious and national epic for Ethiopia. And he talks about the more realistic elements to the Kebra Nagas version of the story. That's not to say all of it is completely more realistic, but just concerning this visit of the Queen of Sheba specifically, it talks about how the Queen of Sheba, Makeda, had this head of her trade envoys called Tamrin, and he had interacted with Solomon, and he came with these rave reviews to the Queen of Sheba about how great Solomon was, and you need to go and see this man. So Ullendorf writes about these more realistic elements within the Ethiopian tradition that predate the Kebra Nagas. This is the formalization of these traditions, and how these point to perhaps a more historical core. Again, it's not to completely defend all the lines in the Kebra Nagas account versus other accounts, but as where it comes to this Queen of Sheba visit in particular. So we have this fierce tradition in Ethiopian history, which matches well with the point of origin that we have from Josephus. It matches well with some of these biblical clues, but really it comes down to, do we have any archaeological...
Yeah, so right now we've been talking about texts that at the very, outside the Bible, very earliest with Josephus, and then we're going even 1400 years after that. So let's go to archaeology, dating, inscriptions. What do we have?
Okay, so... like Patricia Crone said, we have nothing from southwestern Arabia as far as queens go. I think after her text was written, like a second century CE queen was found, but that's much later, like you say. Ullendorf believes we have an early tradition, but he believes that was derived from the New Testament, referring to Candace, queen of Ethiopia, Acts chapter 8. Now, Candace is referring to the Kandakes of Ethiopia or of Sudan. Kandakes, we know a lot about. These were the female regents of this region south of Egypt. And on their own, they're very interesting. We see this emphasis on the female regent during this time period around the turn of the millennium. Going back earlier, we get into the kingdom of Kush period throughout the early, middle, late first century CE. And it's interesting here, there's a researcher by the name of Laszlo Toruk who writes about this period, and he marvels at this emphasis on female regents within Kush. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the time of the black pharaohs of Egypt, the Kushite rulers of the third intermediate period. And you get many, many, many male pharaohs, but they are emphasizing their heritage through a particular female line. And so constantly you're having this emphasis on female succession and the importance of these female regents within this area, which would fit with a Queen of Sheba figure.
Right.
Now, this emphasis goes all the way back into the second millennium BCE, where we have during the reign of Hatshepsut, the female queen of Egypt. She writes about her trade with the land of Punt around the Horn of Africa. There's a female regent there, Queen Ati, a rather girthy woman if you see the pictures, but almost a very Queen of Sheba-esque procession of giving goods from this land of Punt somewhere around the Horn of Africa to Egypt. And then going back,
this is 500 years before Solomon, around that.
Exactly, around 1500 BCE.
Yeah.
And even right back to the 19th, I believe it's 19th century, right at the turn of the second millennium BCE, we have an execration figure which refers to a Sol Queen of Nubia. So you're constantly, archaeologically, you're constantly getting this emphasis on female regents, whether they're female rulers or regents under a male ruler, this important emphasis. There's some scholars, one that I mention in particular in the article, who talk about this, including some of the trade, like from the land of Punt, matching quite well with what the Queen of Sheba brings. She says, I forget the name off the top of my head, but she says, if any queen is delivering these goods to Solomon, it's a queen of Africa. So this is the kind of emphasis that we have. Now, the key is for our period in question, which is the 10th century BCE. And this is really a foggy period. This is within the early third intermediate period. If we're looking at Josephus's reference to Ethiopia, it's more of an emphasis on the Sudan area. This is an area that is basically evacuated by Egypt following the 20th Ramesside dynasty. So this is early 11th century BCE. And basically we have a void for this period with history, with good inscriptions, between the early 11th century to about the 8th century before things really pick up with the Kushite rulers that take over. So we have a real haze in this area, as Turuk explains in his book, with one exception. One really interesting exception, which is found on an inscription at something known as the Semna Temple within Sudan, this area of Nubia, this Kushite heartland. And this inscription, funnily enough, dates to right around this time period, based on historical and paleographical considerations. This inscription dates to about the mid-11th century to mid-10th century, within that window, which is when we have Solomon and our Queen of Sheba. And it belongs to a prominent female ruler. So this is like gold. This is like, could this be the Queen of Sheba? This is what I get into in my article. This is the Semna Stela, or Semna inscription of Katimala.
Katimala.
Variously rendered as Kadamala, Karimala, Katimala, Katimalo, something similar to that. So we've got this big, beautiful picture of the female ruler, Katimala. Right next to her, to the left of her, is a much smaller figure, an attendant. And then on the right side of her, facing her, is the goddess Isis. And then the main hieroglyphic inscription is on the right-hand side of this inscription. So there has been a lot of confusion and questions about what this inscription is, what it means, who is Katimala. Based on some of the historical considerations and dating, she has generally been placed within the early 10th century BCE, our Solomonic time period. She has been speculated as possibly the daughter of Pharaoh Orsukon the Elder at the start of that century, possibly the queen, the wife of Siamon, who was the father-in-law of Solomon, Pharaoh Siamon, or perhaps the queen of his successor, Psusenes. So that is generally how she has been described in the literature, somewhere within that mid-10th century BCE. For my article, I highlight the more recent work of Egyptologist John Coleman Darnell. I have his book here. This is really a great text. He does a thorough study on the Katimala inscription. It's entitled The Inscription of Queen Katimala at Semna. textual evidence for the origins of the Nepatan state. He does not agree that she is some daughter of a pharaoh. He believes that all the evidence points to her as a female Nubian ruler of this nascent, this emerging Nepatan realm to the south of Egypt. He emphasizes various things about the inscription, various elements of her depiction as a Nubian woman and ruler rather than an Egyptian. And he highlights the grammar of the inscription, how that fits well with this time period, and then gets into a lot of the meaning of this inscription. Really confusing inscription, not necessarily for what it says, but for what it means. So this inscription is broken down into a number of parts. At the start, it seems to refer to a male ruler who seems to have been defeated in some kind of battle, probably disabled, probably ultimately deceased, who was then succeeded by his wife, Katamala. And then mm-hmm. Katamala goes on to talk about her feats of war in the mountains of gold within gold mining territory of ancient Nubia. Mm-hmm. And there's enough detail in there to recreate a series of events in which Katamala becomes victorious against these unmentioned enemies, and she establishes her own powerful state centered around the trade of gold. Effectively, she's a gold magnate. And Darnell goes as far as to describe the directions in which her territory emerges, including to an area known as Meroe, which if you go back to Josephus sees Meroe as...
Meroe's in the south.
South of Samna. Josephus describes Meroe as this original city of Saba. So this is Josephus's Saba. So here we have this female ruler generally on the scene at the right time as the Queen of Sheba, about as close as we can get from a single inscription, ruling territory that fits with Josephus and his description of where Sheba was, and this general area of Sheba, as well as this core city of Sheba. We have a key element of gold and this emphasis on gold for this queen. The Bible talks about how much gold that the queen brought to Solomon. It's like we have all these elements, even the eloquence of the inscription itself. Like, it's so hard to decipher this inscription, but Darnell just emphasizes the buried grammar and motifs and imagery in it, how eloquent it is. And this doesn't come through in the translations of it into English. But you pair that up with the visit of the Queen of Sheba to Solomon, and it's like the main emphasis is on testing Solomon with chidot, I think is the Hebrew word, with riddles, literally in Hebrew, or hard sayings, I think it's sometimes translated as. So it's like you have all these elements which come together in the single figure, Katamala, here. So I think she is a really good candidate as the Queen of Sheba, bringing all these pieces together. Can't be sure, can't be certain, but I think with the materials that are available, I think a good case mm-hmm. can be made that this is her.
One thing that I noticed as well is, you mentioned this briefly, is this intervening period of Egyptian weakness basically happening at this time, and then not really as expansive as to being controlling Nubia, where they kind of shrink, and you have this opportunity in this vacuum for a separate kingdom to develop at the same time, as proved by this inscription. And I did that interview with Harel Shochat. He's the ivory expert. You mentioned this briefly. And he's surprised by this, that even during this period of Egyptian weakness, the trade of ivory that is he was able to prove that it comes from the area basically of South Sudan. Even though Egypt was weak, trade in ivory continued through the 11th, 10th, 9th century, indicating that there was a functioning relationship with the area of Nubia at the same time as well.
Yeah, and on that, I included a little quote in my article. I have it here from Professor R.N. Mayer. He says, quote, connections between Judah and Sheba, Yemen, Ethiopia, So there he's referring to the two, the possibilities. Connections between them in the Iron Age, once thought to be completely mythical, are now seen as distinctly possible in light of recent finds. So one of the key examples of that being Shochat's research. One headline was like, this from physics.org says, study finds Levantine ivory came from Ethiopia, not Egypt. So it's like the assumption was it's from this closer location. But like you say, that there is a continuous open trade route with sub-Saharan Africa at this time. So is it too much to believe that the gold, that the precious stones, that the other items mentioned in relation to the Queen of Sheba came through this route as well? I don't think so. And that shrinkage of Egypt up north, I mean, even the capital moves from Memphis much further north to Tanis at this time. This is during the 21st dynasty. It really shrinks up north, and it allows this expansion of the Nubian state. And the early development of this Napatan state blossoming into the eventual Kushite Empire. This evacuation from by the Egyptian kingdom can help explain, I think, what Josephus talks about in describing this queen as being a queen of Egypt and Ethiopia. And then elsewhere, a queen of Ethiopia. So again, more directly, a queen of Ethiopia, Sudan, Ethiopia, take your pick. But also a good chunk of Egypt as well, or what was formerly part of the Egyptian dominion during the New Kingdom period, which extended a lot further south.
Very cool. Okay, thank you very much, Katimala. Queen of Sheba.
Well, Katimala as well. I forgot to mention. There is a possible connection with the name. I talked all about Makeda. In the Kebra Nagast, interestingly enough, it breaks down the etymology of the name as Makeda. Two words, Makeda. And in Katimala's name, I allude to a possible connection there. So her name has been broken up into two parts, Kada and then Mal or Malye. So is it possible that we have a potential connection? Ma, Kada, and Kada, Mala, Ma, La? Potentially. Maybe we...
It is certainly possible, I think. But I think even the more of the evidence that you've given is even leading us to that inference of possibly accepting that. But yeah, definitely... get this article, get the magazine, read through it if you're interested in this. And hopefully as time goes on, we have some more evidence. You know, let's go find another 10th century inscription in Jerusalem, this time with Katimala's name on it. That would be nice.
That's right. And I do want to do a big shout out to the art department, who did a great job with some of these graphics here, including this artist's coloration of the stela. It doesn't have this coloration on it, but this is a possible reflection with the kind of designs, patterns, and outfit that would have been worn at the time, as well as in the text. There's some great visuals in here. Also check out the website article, as well as some additional images, as well as your interview with Dr. Harel Shochat embedded within the article. Great infographic, and there's also a sidebar which wasn't able to be included in the magazine article. There are some additions like that, a little bit on the Pithos inscription as well, in the online article if you'd like to check that out. But yeah, like you say, we're about to go into an excavation season right now. You yourself have written in the magazine about this exciting new area, potentially for Solomonic finds. We're about to start that next week. I apologize for the blank space on my wall. This is where my hat usually goes for excavations. So that is already taken down, ready to begin at the site. So hopefully we'll have some good stuff for our audience if they stay tuned in the near future.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks very much. Have a good evening.
You too. Thank you, Brent.
Thank you very much, Chris, for taking time with us. If you'd like to subscribe to our magazine, as he was mentioning, please go to our website, armstronginstitute.org, and you'll see a place on the front page to subscribe, or write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org and put your name and address, and we'll make sure you are signed up for your free subscription. Thanks very much.